Hey, everybody. A couple of days before Daryl and I recorded the podcast that you're going to hear today, I was having a conversation with a man over dinner. We were talking about the history of and some of the intentions behind government schooling when a strange thing happened. I have, from memory, created a script of this interaction, and I'd like to share it with you now. Scene, dinner table, Sunday evening. Friends, family, and acquaintances have gathered for dinner and some football viewing. Once guests collectively decide they have exhausted speculative conversation about underinflated footballs, the discussion turns to politics. The scene intensifies as Brett, a handsome man in his mid-30s, describes some of the industrialist motivations for expanding the government schools and begins to make connections between that project and the progressive era of the early 20th century, when he is abruptly interrupted. Man, so what do you think of, like, Jenny McCarthy? Brett, what? Man, Jenny McCarthy, you know, and all her views. Brett, is this related to the subject we were just discussing, or are we starting a new subject? Man, I'm just trying to get a sense of how you think. I mean, are you on board with all that? Do you think vaccines are poison and vaccines give people autism? Brett, vaccines give people autism. I don't think so. I don't really know what that means, though. What vaccines would I think do this? And how do they give people autism? And what kind of people? And how many people? Like, out of 100, say. Because it sounds like that statement doesn't have enough information in it for me to make a decision. Man, smugly. Oh. Brett, are you asking me that because if I did see eye to eye with Jenny McCarthy on that issue, you would feel better about the things that I'm saying about education because you could put me in some kind of box as being a kook? Man. I don't know. Maybe. Scene.
Here's the bottom line. An infinitely bigger threat than measles, the measles vaccine, or any vaccine, is giving the state the power to forcibly inject someone against their will.
The anti-vaccination asshole, Andrew Wakefield.
I begin with this proposition. When anyone listens to or seeks medical guidance from Jenny McCarthy or any of her fellow neurosurgeons on The View, they've confessed to having the intellectual power of a dead tree stump, and may even be living in one.
And then now they're using it as a social engineering tool and escalating it into hundreds of shots, and the carnage is clear, and they're doubling down going, we're going to vaccinate pregnant women. We're going to increase the vaccines. Yeah, this year's flu shot doesn't work, so get another one. It's just a pure wall of arrogance. And then now they want to bully everyone into you cause people to get sick and to create a new divide and conquer.
McCarthy's celebrity drivel on vaccination and that of the other healer, Alicia Silverstone, star you will recall of the autobiographical Clueless, amount to offering the world their deep cautions about vaccination and modern medicine. In the last few days, two Republicans in the U.S. have opened another dim window on this so-called debate. McCarthy's had a much longer run. From the emergency room on The View, she has dropped such nuggets as, you ask any mother in the autism community if we'll take the flu or the measles over autism any frickin' day of the week. Only in a society protected by modern medicine and the technologies and pharmaceuticals that have stopped so many illnesses has the arrogance to reject what science, modernity, and medicine have done.
That mountain of data that you have, sir, is diminishing quickly, and I don't think you have any proof that vaccines are safe because that's why you're running from us. Come on. Come on. Come out here, or we can do it on Skype. Debate us. I want to see this mountain of proof that you have. If we should be thrown in jail, give me proof that these things work. Yeah. Show us that we're a bunch of crazy conspiracy nut jobs. Come on, what do you got to lose? So far, your manhood, because you're a coward.
Our next newest co-host is Jenny McCarthy.
The search to find a new woman for the ABC powerhouse The View is over.
She's, of course, opinionated enough to help us begin the latest chapter in The View history.
But some of those opinions are, according to her critics, potentially lethal to children. The former Playmate is no doubt gorgeous and compelling, but Jenny McCarthy is also an outspoken, and many doctors and scientists say, irresponsible voice on the topic of vaccines. She believes immunizations led to developmental problems for her son, Evan, seen here on McCarthy's Twitter feed.
Without a doubt in my mind, I believe vaccinations triggered Evan's autism. So I think they need to wake up and stop hurting our kids.
There may not be a doubt in her mind. The problem is that the credible medical and scientific communities say she is wrong, that numerous studies have found no link between vaccines and autism, and that in this celebrity-suffused culture, McCarthy's words could have a potentially deadly impact by scaring parents away from vaccines.
And that message that she's been giving out has been roundly disproved time and time again. I think it's a really, really unfortunate and in some ways dangerous step that ABC is making.
MIT professor Seth Mnookin wrote about the campaign against vaccines based on falsehoods in his award-winning book, The Panic Virus, the true story behind the vaccine autism controversy.
I think what ABC has done here is further legitimize her views. And those are views that have been shown not only to have absolutely no founding in science, but also to be potentially really dangerous.
We've reached out to ABC for comment, but we have not heard back. One thing is certain, McCarthy is a force to be reckoned with.
They can't survive.
She's written three books about healing autism through the environmental changes she says cured her son. McCarthy's also president of Generation Rescue, a national organization that provides support for the autism community.
When you do raise a concern about an environmental trigger, there is another side that wants to label you, especially us, as an anti-vaccine movement, which is absolutely not true.
We're not telling people not to vaccinate. I don't understand why it's so freaking hard to comprehend we deserve safe shots.
Well, it's hard to comprehend because the vaccines without preservatives McCarthy advocates for are not considered a viable alternative by most experts.
What she's advocating is a return to vaccines that don't have preservatives in them that both keep them safe and also make sure that those vaccines aren't contaminated in any way. So she's proposing something that isn't a realistic option.
As for McCarthy's new permanent position, she released a statement saying in part, "I look forward to making hot topics a little bit hotter."
Then, in the days after Daryl and I recorded, I started to think about this issue more than, honestly, I'd ever thought about it before. Despite there apparently being a lot of listener interest in this subject, I never personally had any skin in the game. It was purely academic for me. My vaccines were done a long time ago, and for most of my adult life, I wasn't making plans to have children. So I just found other academic explorations more interesting and better uses of my time. But the vaccine debate, whatever debate there is, has always been one that I intentionally avoided on the show. Not just because it's so volatile, but because I didn't know enough about it. And enough means a hell of a lot. To feel confident and responsible going into this issue on the show, we're talking full-time work, 40 hours a week for a month, 2 months, three. I don't even know. I can't even estimate. But it's a long way from where I am right now, and that's one of the reasons why I've always steered clear of this. All I knew for certain about the vaccine debate is that it was missing nuance. I basically heard the two sides described as follows. First, you have anti-vaxxers, people who think vaccines cause autism and also believe that they should be avoided. On the other side of this debate were those who were characterized as naive enough to let the government inject anything it wants into you. There had to be something in the middle. And I started to ask questions like, is there such a thing as an anti-vaccine person? What does that mean? Are they retroactively against, like, the smallpox vaccine? The polio vaccine? It seems like after the 20th century, the verdict is in on at least a few vaccines. There's also this argument that vaccines contain dangerous ingredients that are not healthy for human consumption. But what is meant by consumption? Does something have the same effects if it's absorbed through the skin or through the gut or through the bloodstream? I don't know. And what about mercury? Vaccines contain mercury.
Or at least the flu vaccine does.
But is it more mercury than I would find in, say, my appetizer at Red Lobster? And what is the chemical reaction that that mercury has if my body comes into contact with it through a vaccine instead of food, let's say? Now, people who are, I don't even want to say people who are against vaccines. That's my first question. It can't be that black and white. But these people who are more anti than pro, I guess we could say, point out that vaccines contain far more than just mercury as far as dangerous ingredients. Well, I don't think that's controversial at all. Just about everything they give us humans contains things that are dangerous. Most people are eating shitty food out of plastic containers while on pharmaceutical drugs. And just to be clear, I'm saying that in support of those opposed to vaccines. You know, it's not a stretch for me to think a company like Merck might prioritize some kind of short-term benefit, whether it's profit or result, over long-term consequences. I'm not saying, vaccines are fine because we're all doing all kinds of dangerous stuff all the time. I just heated up a Diet Coke in the microwave and drank it. Are there pro-vax people who are arguing with that? But wait a minute. If vaccines do contain things that pose legitimate health risks, is coming into contact with those things worse than having, say, pertussis or smallpox? You would almost think if you looked at the statistics, as far as the spread of these diseases, mostly in the early 20th century, you have a plot on these charts for when the vaccine was brought in and how the diseases are not eradicated, but they drop off so significantly. Even if vaccines did, in some cases, somehow cause autism, if that's what people are saying, wouldn't the risk almost be worth it? When we consider the whole autistic spectrum, if it's something between 1 in 100 and 1 in 150 people actually live with autism, well, what would a vaccine-free world do to those same 100 people? Or do the people who have some opposition to vaccines, whatever that means, have an answer for that? I don't know, I said, so I should Google it. And I did. And what I found was most of the targeting is on the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, and rubella. This is worth pointing out because it seems that these pro-vaccine people have perhaps completely unintentionally made it appear to be too much of a false choice between everybody getting their full vaccine schedule and everybody dying of smallpox. And they would also point out that almost everybody gets the full vaccine schedule and almost nobody has autism. But then a question that I would have is, how has the vaccine schedule changed since, say, I was vaccinated in the late 70s? Are there more vaccines? Have they all been scrutinized equally? The answer is yes, there are more vaccines. And no, the long-term effects of some have not been evaluated as fully and as closely as others. If you're my age, your children might be receiving 3 times as many vaccines as we did. And from what I've gathered so far, the necessity of some of them is questionable. Could it be something in one of these newer vaccines that somehow relates to increased autism diagnosis? Those more in the opposition to vaccine camp say, yay, Brett, you're starting to get it. But wait a minute, I have more questions. As far as the autism thing is concerned, are we seeing a correlative relationship or a causative relationship? Because yes, everybody knows that the autism diagnosis is occurring at a much greater frequency today than it was 10, 20, or 30 years ago. I also know from my experience working in the so-called education field from 1999 to 2013 that the autism diagnosis criteria broadened significantly to include Asperger's syndrome in the mid-1990s. And I'm not sure how people trying to establish a correlation between vaccines and autism account for this fact. But of course, correlation is not causation. Autism diagnoses did increase significantly during my time as a teacher and a tutor. Correlating with other things like GMO foods, homes with internet access, the occurrences of black presidents being elected, and Super Bowls numbering in the 40s. The only attempt at establishing a causative relationship that I know of was a study done in 1998 by a British doctor named Andrew Wakefield.
Now let's pause right there for a minute at Andrew Wakefield. Earlier in this monologue, I tried to establish an estimate of how much time in research it would take me before I felt like I was being responsible talking about this issue on the show in front of thousands of people in great detail, which I am not doing today. I'm raising questions. The Wakefield thing, it seems pretty cut and dry that Andrew Wakefield was completely discredited in the years following his study, that he engaged in fraud. But then I see him on Alex Jones this week, as if there has never been any mark on his credibility. Now, yes, of course, I understand that Infowars.com, not exactly the credibility police, but it tells me that there's more to his story, even though there are some pretty hard to ignore, pretty irresponsible to ignore financial conflicts of interest swirling around the study, mostly related to planned litigation. It's also worth pointing out that according to the British Medical Journal, the recruitment of test subjects was done by anti-MMR campaigners. But of course, it's very easy to follow up that statement with the allegation that the British Medical Association is trying to do a hatchet job on Wakefield to protect the financial interests of pharmaceutical companies. So again, and this is no defense, believe me, of Andrew Wakefield, if somebody just looks at the surface of these controversies, it's easy to see how he or she could come away with the idea that, oh, this is just a wash. So long story long, what I realized was on the Wakefield issue alone, inside this much larger debate, there's several hours of research needed right there. There was also a lot of buzz recently about a whistleblower from the CDC named William Thompson. Same issue, by the way, a causative relationship between the MMR vaccine and autism. But from what I've gathered so far, again, a research project needing many hours, that report seems to be pretty deceptive. And this is really frustrating, quite honestly, because every place I've looked in this debate, there seems to be a tremendous amount of smoke screens and noise and fallacies and attacks. So then I started to think, if I have all these questions and so little information, in fact, that I feel that it is irresponsible to talk about it on the show, which without a doubt it would be. But standing where I am, with all these questions, looking at this debate that seems so nonsensical, it ultimately occurred to me that I might have fallen for complete mischaracterizations of each side in the debate. Shortly after my dinner with a guy who you might remember from the script I read as Man, I started to ask myself, how similar am I to Jenny McCarthy? And then it occurred to me, I honestly had no idea what Jenny McCarthy thought. So I began an investigation using a site called YouTube.
10 vaccines for your schedule, you know, back in the day, 1983. And now the schedule of saying, hey, welcome to the world, child. Here's your schedule. It's now 36 shots.
There's 36 inoculations.
Yes.
And
yes.
You're saying they are the cause?
Glad you brought that up. No, I do not believe that vaccines are the sole cause for autism. I do believe they are a trigger. They are a trigger. And the dumbest way to explain it, though, is for me is if you become overweight, you might trigger diabetes.
But
so there's something in the immune system that is weakened in these kids that maybe can't process the vaccines. I don't think it's solely the vaccines. I think there's toxins in the environment, pesticides for pregnant women. It's kind of like a pileup. If you can fill up a bucket of all this stuff going on with these kids, and if they have a weak immune system, all that crap is going to overflow.
What are you going to do, ban vaccinations?
Heck no.
Oh,
I am completely for them.
So.
I would like the CDC to get a better schedule. 36. I would like to see them clean up the ingredients. I would like for parents to feel safer by offering the families a test for their baby to see if their immune system is strong enough to handle these. I would love the CDC to give a piece of paper before they give my child a Hep B shot in the hospital saying, here are the possible side effects for each shot. I think parents would feel a lot safer, and they're not right now.
So is this what people are upset about? Because based on how I had heard her position summed up, that certainly wasn't the ramblings of a completely insane person. Now, there are significant scientific holes in what she's saying, and this gets into another major research project. There is a question of what an alternative vaccine schedule would be, what would be the methodology for developing that schedule, and what was the methodology for developing the vaccine schedule that the CDC recommends. There's also the counter-argument that because of cleaner vaccines than the ones used in the pre-1989 period, she mentioned that people are actually now coming in contact with fewer immunological components. But I wasn't horrified by what Jenny McCarthy said, and I'm a little disappointed in myself for using her as a shorthand for pseudoscientific insanity without doing any investigation into her position at all. Here's one more clip of McCarthy from Larry King, this time appearing years later with her boyfriend and star of the movie Earth Girls Are Easy, Jim Carrey.
No one has ever suggested not vaccinating.
Going back to the 1989 schedule, when shots were only 10 and the MMR was on that list. I don't know what happened in 1990. There was no plague that was killing children that we had to triple the amount of vaccines.
What happened after 1989?
The vaccine
schedule warranted 26 more vaccines.
Greed.
Are all of them absolutely necessary?
Because they want to make money.
Of course. Okay. Back in 1989, the shot schedule was 10 shots given.
10 shots given.
When I was a kid, what do we get, 3?
It's twice as many as anywhere else in 30 countries in the Western world.
But
we give twice as many shots as any of those countries. Why is that?
If it's vaccination and you're not against vaccination,
right?
Well, what are you against? Don't vaccinate for this, but vaccinate for that?
Yes.
I think we have to choose which ones are absolutely necessary.
You should educate yourself. We want to empower parents to educate themselves. Do we need to have the chickenpox? Do we need the hepatitis B shot on the second day of life?
I don't think we can afford to assume that the people who are charged with our public health any longer have our best interests at heart all the time. Parents have to make their own decisions, educated decisions. They have to look at the information.
Space out the vaccines, delay them till after one, clean out the toxins that are in them. We don't need that many.
When the other doctors are here, and they will be on the other side in a while after you leave.
Grab them and stab them, you mean?
That was one.
This is my nickname.
Well, what will
them.
They say? Why would a doctor not want to know more about something that could save a life or prevent a disease? I don't understand.
The AAP is financed by the drug companies. Medical schools are financed by the drug companies. This is a huge business. Vaccines are the largest growing division of the pharmaceutical industry. $13 billion.
They control
profit.
Medical schools. These doctors are not learning about prevention or vitamins or diets.
What we're asking is for them to take a loss for the good of our children. That's a tough sell in a boardroom.
And for, you know, as a precautionary measure right now, you know, you remove certain medications off shelves because they're deemed unsafe. Why not vaccines?
But what if this is a trick? Even though the vaccine skepticism movement, in my opinion, is not a mystical or pseudoscientific cult, does it have those cult-like layers that you might also find in governments or corporations? The exoteric, the public face, and the esoteric, the hidden message or agenda or directives. So in the case of Jenny McCarthy and her campaign, her movement, on television, it's, oh, yeah, we actually think vaccines are good and people should get vaccinated. We're not anti-vaccine in any way. But then is there an inner circle where the directives are different? And here's why I raised that question. And I'm not raising that question to suggest anything. But the more I looked into the history of the anti-vaccine movement generally, or the vaccine skepticism movement, that's actually a much better word, I found that there has been some goalpost moving. It seems that in the 1990s, most of the targeting was mercury, in vaccines containing thimerosal as a preservative. The green vaccine movement really grew in the last decade. But in the late 90s, I think in 1999, the CDC actually removed thimerosal from every vaccine except the seasonal flu vaccine. So to change targets, as far as the movement is concerned, without losing momentum, that raises questions for me. And there are a variety of motives and motivators for the anti-vaccine movement. And I couldn't research all of them for this monologue. And I guess that's the point of this monologue. I'm frustrated. It took me like 3 hours of research to just talk to you for 20 minutes and convey how little I know about this debate. So I'll conclude with what the certainties are. The debate is very troubled emotionally, and it lacks curiosity, empathy, and patience on both sides. And as a result of that, it lacks nuance. After we released the first episode, a friend of the show named Kevin Geary from Rebooted Body posted an article that he wrote. The article was called Bringing Much-Needed Sanity to the Vaccine Debate, and I recommend you read it. He actually pointed out a couple of things that we addressed in the first show. But if there is no sanity, there is no debate. There's just two groups of people throwing their poop at each other. And that activity definitely poses a health hazard. Now, from the comments that I've gathered so far about the first show in this series, people were intrigued by teasers, but they wanted to see where things are going to go. And I understand that, but from what I've seen so far online, and I'm not talking about in our group, but from what I've observed about these types of scientific debates so far, I think it would be wise to take things nice and slow here and devote an entire show to trying to better map rational discourse and to better understand how the acknowledgement of emotion can enhance that discourse and the overlooking of emotions can destroy it. And I agree with Daryl, as he originally stated in his outline, that's our best move. Before we go any further with this examination of scientific consensus versus scientific dissent. And just as an appetizer here, I wanted to include two short clips from a CBS show called The Doctors. The Doctors is a spinoff of Dr. Phil. It is a mainstream medical discussion talk show. This episode was called Autism Debate with Jenny McCarthy, and the description reads, Jenny McCarthy, Dr. Jerry Cartzenell, and J.B. Handley, co-founder of Generation Rescue, join the doctors to discuss the causes of autism. Are vaccines to blame? And I think this will provide a fine example of what I've been talking about for the last 20-something minutes regarding the quality of this debate. I mean, these people are television personalities. And even they have trouble maintaining calm and rationality during this discussion. That was a little irony if you missed it. But I will say this conversation does include some interesting revelations. And I mean that in an emotional sense. Here we go.
The devil is always in the details. And one of the problems with vaccines is they've been so great that people overly generalize about them as if they're only great. We looked at other first world countries. We're 34th. In under 5 mortality behind such luminaries as Cuba and Slovenia. However, we have 36 vaccines. The top 5, which include countries like Finland, Norway, Iceland, average 11 and 13 vaccines. From 1994, we added 8 vaccines to our schedule. There are vaccines like flu, rotavirus, varicella that have only been picked up by 2 or 3 of the other 30 countries. So what do they know that we don't? Why aren't they picking up vaccines that have been around for 15 years? And why are their autism rates 1 in 1,000, 1 in 1,500, 1 in 2,000? It doesn't take a brain surgeon or an ER doctor to figure out there might be a correlation.
We don't want to be too narrow-minded and say it's only the vaccines and ignore other potential problems.
In my opinion, and this is just me wanting to have an open debate about this, vaccines are really the one thing we have looked at as causing autism.
Yeah,
that is completely bogus. No, that is such a bogus statement. How many vaccines have they looked at in these studies? How many? What's the answer? It's 2. How many ingredients have they studied of 35? What's the answer? It's 1. you've looked at two of 36 shots and one of 35 vaccines, and you're going to stand on the stage and say that vaccines and autism are unrelated? It is the most bogus tobacco science. It's a smokescreen. Anybody who takes the time to read it would agree. I'm so sick of doctors who don't read the studies, who don't know the details, sitting here telling parents and reassuring them that vaccines don't cause autism. It is irresponsible.
And this is the biggest problem, and the reason that doctors in this country are frustrated.
Read the
because,
science.
Listen, all you're doing is you're antagonizing a medical community that wants to help these kids.
You haven't done the research.
You're antagonizing me. You're antagonizing Dr. Sears.
Right.
Why would you do that? This show is all about
my son.
Okay, you know, and it, okay, everyone wants to blame someone, right? Yes. This is what it's. What we're trying to figure out here is how to help kids. But all you do when you yell at me on my stage, all you do is anger me.
I'm sorry,
and
I
make
hurt your feelings,
me,
but you didn't know the details.
I asked you to defend your stance, and all you did was attack me. As an individual, why would I want to listen to you when you do that to me?
Because
instead, I want to listen to Dr. Jerry here, who will rationally walk through why they're removing certain things from foods that could be causing problems, why we're removing environmental toxins that could be causing autism. You know, I want to help these kids live better lives just like everyone else. I don't understand why we all have to argue so much with one another, because when you attack, all you do is create frustration.
We are so tired of not being heard, and we're so tired of hearing doctors like the second doctor there who says it's been proven that vaccines and autism are unrelated. It's simply untrue, and it's maddening as a parent to know the truth. It's maddening as a doctor to take these phone calls. It's maddening to take all the calls.
You don't know the truth. The point of this whole debate and the talking about autism is we don't know all the things that are going on in our environment. There are environmental toxins out there. There are things in our food, and there are so many possible things in our universe that could be making autism symptoms worse.
Yeah.
And to say that you have the truth and 99.9% of pediatricians don't is just, let's find a common ground here where we can all work towards solutions. Vaccines have been studied, and you know what? Let's continue to study vaccines. Let's study.
Exactly. Yeah, they've been so looked at, scrutinized. I mean, that's the one of all the things out there that it could be. They've been looked at so carefully over the last few years, though.
You
that's
have to be honest about the science. We're just asking for people to be honest about what's actually been done.
Let's
just take a step back, Dr. Jerry. We know with certainty that vaccines cause brain injury in a certain percentage of children. We pay it out in vaccine court. It's on the website. We know with certainty, and maybe one of the reasons that I'm angry, and I am definitely angry, and I apologize if I cross the line with you personally, but we take the phone calls from the parents who go to the vaccine visit, who get six shots, who lose their kid, because they stop coming to the pediatricians. Okay?
There's a tremendous increase in autism. There's no question about that. There's a tremendous increase in other illnesses as well. Let's have an open discussion. That's why we have Jenny here today.
Daryl, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Brett. Thanks for having me back.
My pleasure. In the first installment, we identified some problems, and today we are going to discuss how to talk about them with others. I just wanted to go through the problems that we identified, maybe review them a little bit, and then we'll get on to today's conversation.
Excellent.
Our first discussion was essentially about scientific consensus versus dissent, and how in a lot of discussion, the concept of dissent seems to be undervalued, even though dissent is very important in moving science forward. One of the things that you pointed out was there's a problem with the idea of scientific consensus itself, right?
Right. If you really do your trivium work, meaning that you actually are identifying each aspect of grammar, you do the grammar for consensus and you realize that it is a unanimously held decision. What people are often referring to when they say the words, quote, scientific consensus, they are referring to a scientific majority or even the most widely publicized scientific opinion, which does not even have to be a majority.
Yeah. So what's important about this, or another thing that's important about this, is a lot of discussions that are potentially productive and educational are being stopped in their tracks. I think, first of all, because of this very important misunderstanding of an extremely powerful word, consensus.
Right. Now, this is very critical. We're making these shows to help people have better discussions and to try to promote the idea of a discussion, which is completely different than the idea of a debate. So for folks who remember the political debate contract on the School Sucks Project website, this is something that's a little bit different here. We're going to be covering the Our Discussion flowchart, something that was brought to my attention by Ben Stone of the BadQuaker.com podcast.
Yeah.
So this is we're going to cover that flowchart a little bit. I'm going to go through some of the aspects that I have revealed, meaning the purposes of any discussion and the utility or helpful in what way? How does it help to make life more wonderful for both participants?
And a contrast to that, in many ways, a contrast to that, you mentioned this political debate contract, which was something that I developed in 2012. And it says on my site, for honest, rational, and meaningful discussions about important issues. And I swore to myself and the audience and everyone I showed this to a couple years ago that I was going to print this out. And if a conversation about a political or social or educational or philosophical or economic issue became heated, I was going to open my little manila envelope and pull this out with a pen and request that the other person read and sign it and fill in the blanks where they're appropriate. Unfortunately, that never happened. So it didn't turn out to have too much real-world utility, but I still think it has some value. Even though I conceived it in, admittedly, a pretty hostile mood, I think there are some important aspects to it, but the Our Conversation flowchart that we're going to present today is much more constructive, and that's really only one part of what we want to do today, right?
Right, because having your intellectual terrain, your own, and even helping manage someone else's intellectual terrain, having that harmonious is only half of the aspect. There's a whole other aspect called emotional harmony, the emotional terrain of yourself and the other individual that you're conversing with.
So why don't we jump into this, and we're going to talk about it as we go. I highly recommend that the people listening make the visual aid available to themselves. We will try to make it as visual as possible for our listeners. The title of this is a flowchart to help you determine if you're having a rational discussion. And I'm pulling this from 22words.com. It will be linked in the show notes.
Right under our discussion on the flowchart, it says, thank you for requesting to have a discussion with me about this topic. Discussions are a dialogue between people in which the participants are willing to alter their position if it makes sense to do so. Sometimes people confuse discussion with sermon or lecture. These non-discussions are a waste of time since all parties are intractable in their existing views. So that our time is not wasted, please use this guide to determine whether we can actually have a discussion about this topic. I want to once again say that sometimes a sermon or lecture has utility if the person listening or even the person delivering it can see applications or open up new avenues of discussion or exploration.
Mm, absolutely. Sometimes discussions are actually two people who want to give a sermon.
Right. And to identify that,
yeah,
that comes down to what I often am identifying first off is what are the purposes of our discussion? And I've isolated three of them. Brett isolated one of them for me. One of them was convincing. Am I having a discussion to convince this person? One of them was sharing. Am I having a discussion to share with the person something that I found valuable or intriguing? Am I having the discussion for exploration purposes? Because I'm seeing that, hey, I think this is hot. This is leading somewhere.
Yes. Another purpose for a discussion or even a debate or an argument is measurement. Measuring your presentation against mainstream opinions. What are things that you might say that elicit strong emotional responses in other people that could shut a discussion down? Learning not to say those things in the future. I used to have a lot of political arguments with somebody that I would describe very simply as having no filter. They would say whatever they think about you whenever you say something. Now, this some people might want to stay far away from this because of the hostility of it. But I learned a lot from it. I felt like if I brought up something that was controversial, and I mean, some people who listen to a show like this might be surprised what people out there consider controversial. You know, some people might hear you say something like, I don't believe in God, and they would find that to be outrageous. So, I mean, just as an example, I felt like I was having a lot of discussions with nice, polite, ordinary folks, and they were thinking I was deeply disturbed or crazy, but not saying it, and just kind of allowing the discussion to continue. So if you can find somebody who will be a little bit more honest with you, even if it is because they simply do not have that polite conversation filter, it can be very instructive. And it's a good way to measure some of your arguments and some of your presentation style against mainstream thinking and the subsequent emotional responses.
Right. And I wanted to add one more tool to your intellectual methods, because we'll get to our emotional toolbox second. But first off, a very excellent intellectual tool for everyone to use in a discussion is called pen and paper. So that while someone else is talking, just like I'm doing while Brett is talking, I'm writing things down that occur to me. And as far as I know, Brett is often doing the same thing, the jotting things down, typing things up, things like that. And so things are being saved. So instead of having the pressure building up where the urge to interrupt someone pops up, you actually are saving valuable information and yet allowing the other person to continue in their flow.
You know, another thing that's really important, you talked about the purposes, convincing the other person or doing an exploration. These are things that have to be, that magic word for both parties, voluntary. You shouldn't be, you know, having an interaction with a person who doesn't want to be convinced and calling it a discussion, as this flowchart is going to demonstrate. So the voluntary participation is very important, and choosing people who have that curiosity. Unless you're purely going for the measurement purpose that I mentioned, you want to make sure that the goals are clear and that it is voluntarily undertaken by both parties.
Right. And I'm going to add that there is a powerful use in revealing your purposes silently to yourself first, because it might be embarrassing if you suddenly realize, I'm trying to convince this person. And you could choose to go down a different path, saying, I was trying to convince them, but now that I see that I was trying to do that, maybe I can choose a different purpose to reveal. Or you can just straight up reveal your purposes to the person. Then yeah. You could also reveal, this whole discussion will be helpful in some way. What ways? What ways will it be helpful to you or to them? You can reveal this, these suspicions that you have, or you could have potential ways that it's useful, or you could have actual, tangible, kinetic ways that it's useful.
The chart that we're going to go through here is a series of questions that the first three anyway have to be answered yes in succession, or the discussion suddenly comes to an end, which is probably best for all parties involved. But do you want to start with this first question that should be raised?
Sure. Can you envision anything that will change your mind on this topic?
Yeah.
And it progresses either yes or no. Yes goes to the next two questions. And no goes to, this is not a discussion. I will not talk to you about this topic.
Right. And one of the important things that I pointed out before, and from my own experience anyway, is that this question usually manifests in some form much later in the discussion, where there might be a considerable amount of unnecessary tension had this question been raised at the beginning. And it usually shows up in the form of, well, is there anything I can do to convince you, right? But by then, it might be too late, right? There's too much hostility. There's too much tension. The rift is too wide. But raising this question right at the beginning not only is a real time saver, if you're interested in saving time, but it gets the other person to think about what we've already talked about, the goals behind the discussion itself.
Right. And that is critical, in my opinion, to share with the other person would be helpful, but with yourself is critical. Because if you don't know why you're doing anything, including having a discussion with someone, if you're not very clear on all of your hidden agendas going on, you could be creating an architecture that's unstable. And I'm talking about an intellectual and an emotional architecture that's not conducive to harmony.
So again, the first question, can you envision anything that will change your mind on this topic? If that question is answered yes, you can move on to the second question. If one of your arguments is shown to be faulty, will you stop using that argument with everyone?
Right. Now, this is an application of actual informal logic, or the informal logical fallacies. just to isolate, is there some problem? Like just simply saying, for example, I'm going to believe in God because I'm just gonna, and mm-hmm. I'm not going to ever stop. And I'm not even going to define what that means. I just found a utility and harmony, emotionally speaking, by thinking those words and by following along the flow in myself when I continue just imagining that series of words and the way I feel about it. That's an example.
I think it's also what you try to do to the other person as far as faulty arguments are concerned. How you try to position yourself against their arguments. So one of the examples that I used in the political debate contract was trying to avoid the box. While the discussion must stay on the agreed upon topic, the parties involved should agree to abstain from trying to put this other person in a box, which is basically a tactic where there's an attempt to control the context of the discussion in a way that's advantageous to one person. So some examples of this using the fallacies would be the straw man, you know, oversimplifying their argument in a way that it's easy to attack or burn down, loaded questions or trap setting, and of course, the goalpost moving or the retreat, which is essentially the logical fallacy of special pleading. So and another example that comes up a lot, lifeboat scenarios, trying to put people in some kind of extreme situation to force agreement or retreat from a certain position. Those would all be examples of faulty argumentation.
What occurred to me was that there is a powerful utility in everyone who's conversing having a knowledge, an explicit knowledge of the informal logical fallacies, or at least 12 of them, just to start with, and making some explicit agreement to say, I'm aware of these. I am very interested in not using these for the purpose of this discussion. I'm interested in using supportive evidence that I'm going to make claims to. And if everyone is on the same page with that, that's great. But there are many people who are not aware of the informal logical fallacies. They are not aware of any of them. And so they take those informal logical fallacies and think that those are supportive evidence. Those are to be used as supportive evidence. And that's an issue right there. So when we get to the emotional toolbox side, I have a few things to deal with this situation. But intellectually speaking, that's what this our discussion flowchart is all about. It's all as if you have no emotions and the other person has no emotions. And we can just be perfectly rational people where only the slimmest cobweb of empathy between us exists. And we can just cross with our 18-wheelers on a cobweb.
Sure. Right. I mean, there's a huge thing missing here. While this flowchart is useful, becoming somebody else's reason coach while you're debating them is probably going to have emotional implications for the other person as well. Like, okay, well, you know, you're using faulty arguments, so I'm going to ask you to stop. If the discussion has already some emotional momentum to it, in a lot of cases, that's going to be a very, very difficult thing to do, even though it's necessary to do. Not to bully people by pointing out the fallacies, but to enter them into the record is very important in one form or another.
To me, a discussion is like going out to enjoy a dinner with someone. And a debate is like attending an eating contest. One of them is fun. One of them is fun for the participants. One of them, I can tell you, is not fun for the participants. Maybe it's fun for the winner who just somehow able to eat more hot dogs somehow and gain the trophy or the prize. But I think in the end, they're going to suffer for that prize, you know. So yeah. I just wanted to like focus on that right there. When you go and have a dinner, there is no contest. There is no tension. If possible, the dishes are bought out and they're not taken away from you before you're finished. And we'll get to that one in a moment. You're able to just take your time. You're not being evaluated by the other person, usually, hopefully, by how you eat your food. You know, you can eat your food the way you eat it. They eat their food the way they eat it, you know?
And
it's just like that. It's all relaxed and casual. So a debate where there's an attempt to find a winner or loser intellectually is by its very nature a problem. And I wanted to isolate that with that metaphor.
So if the answer to that second question, if one of your arguments is shown to be faulty, will you stop using that argument with everyone? If that question is answered in the affirmative, where do we go from here?
Next box says, are you prepared to abide by basic principles of reason in discussing this topic? As an example, the position that is more reasonable and has more supporting evidence should be accepted as true. The person asserting a position bears the onus of demonstrating its truth. So once again, this is a study of informal logic, of inductive and deductive reasoning, of understanding how it works in the first place. And by the way, you could have a bunch of different points that you're using as supportive evidence. So you could say that's more supportive evidence. But as you take each piece of evidence, you have a chance to evaluate to see, is it holding up to scrutiny? Can you find problems in it? And, you know, there are things in the medical world that I certainly go through where I'm saying, wait a second, you're saying a test has proven something, but what does exactly that test show? What is the mechanism by which that test actually works? And if you do not have an answer to that, then I can say, well, I actually know how that lab test works. I can tell you how that works. So you see, something is supportive evidence up until when you actually look at the supportive evidence.
Yeah, you know, I don't really see a place for it here in the flowchart, but something else that is just as important, if not more important, is proper identification and definition.
That's grammar. You've done a bunch of shows with Gino Denning. You did 4 shows with me covering a little bit of the trivium applied to communication. Grammar is crucial. You're not done with grammar ever. You could put grammar aside when you're ready to make an actual tangible decision, when you're actually ready to write something. That's a tangible action, by the way. But at the moment when you're still musing over various ideas and supportive evidence, you always have time, assuming you're not under pressure to do something tangible. You always have time to go over your grammar of definitions. Here's the definition. Here's where I'm getting the definition from. Provide a link. You know, when you're typing away, it's easy enough to copy and paste a link. Mm-hmm. And you could be honest and say, I'm using this definition from my own mind. This is a very ubiquitously used definition. People are commonly using this definition. Here's a hot word, capitalism. And people will, you know, come up with a definition for that word. And I can imagine certain liberty-loving people using a different definition for that word. So
it also brings up for me the problem in some discussions of what I would call over-accuracy, defining things, especially that have to do with, let's say, government, in a way that is so stark, it elicits a strong emotional response that can end the discussion abruptly, calling taxation theft.
That's a hot one.
Schooling indoctrination. So I guess I shouldn't call it over accuracy. I should call it letting your own feelings become involved in definitions. Can be a dangerous practice if you are hoping for and aiming for a productive discussion.
Right. When we get into the emotional toolbox and I define empathy as I use that word, I think that will have some tangible application to this.
Sure.
But continuing down the flowchart, if you have answered those 3 questions in the affirmative, this is a discussion. I will talk to you about this topic, provided the following rules are obeyed. 1, do not introduce new arguments while another argument has yet to be resolved. And by that, I would say yet to be resolved to the satisfaction of both participants.
Absolutely. The second one, do not move on to another argument if it is shown that a fact you have relied upon is inaccurate.
That's similar to not feeling resolved on that particular claim being made. And I'm going to use the word claim now in place of argument because there are 4 aspects that I analyze intellectually when people are stating things to me or when I'm stating things to them. I'm trying to isolate what is the claim being made. What are the concerns being raised? What are requests, such as universal or actions on their part or even on my part being made? There could be requests being made. And what is simply, apparently, just the sharing of information?
Mm-hmm.
So in isolating claims and seeing that apparently the supportive evidence for a claim seems inaccurate, as I was alluding to with certain medical laboratory tests, I would have to say I could point to half dozen tests off the top of my head and a whole lot more if I just kept investigating, that there's a public opinion of what the laboratory test is supposed to show evidence for, and then there's actual reality for what how the test is built and what it actually shows. And, you know, the cholesterol myth is one example of that, where they there has been a concerted effort to move the goalposts of a so-called healthy cholesterol level in adult humans. And they kept moving it down and down and down. And, of course, that allows certain people to prescribe medicines that would further rip cholesterol out of people's bodies. And that's not all it does, too, but that's what happens when you have an assumption that the medicine only does one thing. You know, there's the linear thinking problem again.
Yeah, it's hard to, on the fly, establish the necessary context. And it's another thing that I think participants should be really gauging in the other person, how much context is missing. Because, I mean, from my experience, if somebody doesn't know anything about the history of education, what am I talking about? Why would a person even say the things that I say? So especially with some of these more complex discussions, that should be something that as the conversation is getting started, that each participant should be asking of the other, what contextual knowledge do you have of this subject? Because it's very easy to come to a conclusion. I mean, when you don't know anything, it seems like you know everything. Trying to establish the other person's contextual knowledge, I think, is really important. And also trying to establish your own.
Right. So my knowledge of Inglis is limited, and your reading of Inglis is advanced, but we can just put that out there on the plate right away and have an understanding, and we can go further. There's a utility to reiterating or restating the purposes throughout the discussion of why you're having the discussion in the first place, because the claim that you're just there to share and explore and remeasure these items that you're bringing up in a discussion might not be believed, because the first idea of convincing or persuading could be within the other person's mind. They could be thinking, you're trying to persuade me. I don't like that. I don't like being persuaded. That leaves a bad taste in my mind. So, you know, then I'm just giving you, like, that's an intellectual harmony tool. You can go back, you can restate your purposes, you can reveal again, in what way will this discussion be helpful?
Absolutely. You want to take the third one?
Provide evidence for your position or arguments. Basically, what is the supportive evidence that you're going to point to make your claims or concerns?
Yeah, I know this might seem like an odd place to insert this, Daryl, but can we talk a little bit, too, about pen and paper? Because I think it's actually relevant here when it comes to evaluating the evidence of somebody else's arguments.
There's a common desire for people to have continuity or flow. People are working hard, often harder than you might even imagine, to create a harmonious intellectual and emotional landscape for themselves while having a discussion that they might have had too many debates in their life where there was a winner or loser, kind of the eating contest aspect.
Sure.
And there were many times where people have been interrupted by other people, and they have learned the habit of interrupting other people. Sort of whoever can speak louder and faster and interrupt more can have a chance of seeming to be more correct. So pen and paper.
The other benefit, and the reason why I brought it up right here at number three, provide evidence for your position or arguments, it's also a chance to write down some of what the other person is saying. Arguments can happen pretty rapidly. Things could be slipped by. The more conversations like this you have, the more practice you get. But if you identify the argument, an argument that somebody else is making as, you know, essential to their overall thesis here, writing it down and asking for clarification, it's a defensive tool. When we're just talking about, you know, this from a purely logical stance, recording the other person's arguments can help you go back and get clarity where you need it.
Right. And it's also a harmonious tool when we get to the emotional toolbox, that you feel more at ease and having internal balance and equilibrium when, instead of feeling confused because you don't have any tools like pen and paper, things are going past you. You're like, oh, yeah, that. And oh, I want to say that as soon as I get a chance. And I can't wait any longer. I'm going to interrupt now.
Yeah,
there's that aspect of urgency. the urgency can be put aside when you have a simple pen and paper tool.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The fourth one, the fourth requirement here, do not argue that you do not need evidence. I've had some pretty wild debates in my life. I don't think I've ever heard that one.
Well, if you've discussed the God issue, then you might have faced this one. You might have faced this with people who would declare that they don't need definitions or that they don't need a link to a definition. Mm-hmm. And I've faced this plenty, certainly. I faced a very outrageous claim and concern recently regarding my birth in New York State. And the claim being made by this person who has Native ancestry, although not specifically of the Seneca groups that were living in that area, the claim was, you know, he was speaking for all Native group, you know, peoples on the so-called modern day North America, mm-hmm. was that my parents choosing to have me born there was an act of violence against all the tribes there. And that it certainly that wasn't my fault because I was simply just being born, you know.
Yeah.
But the fact that I was being born there was my parents' act of violence, and my choosing to stay within the so-called United States was continuing that in knowledge of things going on. Now, that's a claim, and mm-hmm. I can see the concern. Of course, it was missing crucial grammar, meaning that this is a world filled with refugees who are all over the place now. I'm just one of like billions at this point. We're refugees everywhere. There are a few people who have a line of ancestral continuity along a certain geographic area. And all the way back into antiquity, new people were still moving around, you know, joining into tribes and going into new areas and occasionally harmoniously and occasionally with disharmony. So it just, in the lack of clear thinking, there was just the claim, the intractable, unmovable claim that my birth in that area was an act of violence by my parents. And that's just a fascinating thing to look at. And I chose to do the cost-benefit analysis of continuing the discussion with this person. I chose, it was so unprofitable that I just didn't even want to go there, you know?
It sounds like a wise choice based on what you've told me about it. I've definitely heard that definitions are unnecessary. I've never heard somebody, you know, clearly argue that they did not need evidence. But when I've asked for clarification of definitions, I've been told that I'm engaging in some kind of semantic misdirection. That's pretty common, that I'm trying to get hung up on semantics instead of moving forward with the evidence. And that's just as bad, if not worse.
I have seen that claim too coming at me. And I think that each of these two things touch upon the disharmony, emotionally speaking, that disharmony happened and we're getting really close to the end of our discussion, which is an intellectual tool. And we're going to really find some utility in the emotional toolbox.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's one more question here that presents us with the verdict of how things went.
Right. Did you breach any of these rules in the discussion? And of course, if the answer is no, congratulations, this is how rational human beings exchange ideas. And that's a great definition for discussion, an exchange of ideas. This is the dinner party. This is, we're just eating casually together. There is no shoving it down and trying to prove anything of like Brett proving how many hot dogs he can shove down faster than me. This is nice and simple, and we're getting somewhere.
Yeah.
Nutrition and health.
Absolutely. The hot dog thing is a separate event.
Yes, and to be announced later at Porkfest. Now, if you did breach any of these rules in the discussion, yes, you cheated. The discussion is terminated. You are deemed to have conceded all opposing arguments up to this point. You forfeit any right to complain about the discussion. Now, I want to take issue with those three things. The person did not follow those rules. That is a choice. That's not cheating. That's just simply their habit or, you know, their choice of action, basically. Now, you know, you could call that cheating if you want to give it a word, but I think it's just more of like there's a cause and effect. It's one of the seven hermetic principles of cause and effect. If you choose a certain action, there's going to be an effect. That's like the cost-benefit analysis that I did in discussing my birth with this person of Native American ancestry. There was, you know, there's going to be a cost to taking a certain position or to not utilizing a certain methodology in discussion. And I'm going to make a choice based upon how does it affect my life. The fact that, you know, this is a claim that you are deemed to have conceded all opposing arguments up until this point. No, they haven't. They can hold in their mind whatever conclusions they wish to.
Yeah.
That's what's voluntary. That's what's free.
Not the fallacy, but it's like the fallacy, right?
Sure. People have the freedom to utilize fallacies as their methodology of decision making. I covered this clearly when we covered The Trivium Applied to Communication, those four shows. I said people are going to use this as their method of decision making. So to understand that and to begin to develop respect for their voluntary choice is the beginning of harmony in yourself. Just to say that's their trip, that's their path, that's their methodology so far. We don't know what they'll choose next month or next year.
That is quite a relieving thing to say to yourself.
Isn't it? You get freedom like that, yeah? And the next one, you forfeit any right to complain about the discussion. No, people are also voluntarily free to complain all they wish to everyone and to themselves about everything. This is a method. This is why children are filled with observations that can be interpreted as complaints, because they are aiming for consistency, usually.
Yes.
And that consistency is visible when you actually do see a child who is in extreme degrees of harmony with themselves and with others around them. You can see this because they're in the moment. They're in the now. They are not thinking about girlfriend's past or, I could say, economic hardships future. You know, that's all taken care of. They have no girlfriend's past or boyfriend's past. They're just, they're little ones, 3 years old or under. They're in the present moment. And you have a chance to be that too, because we're going to get into emotional tools very soon.
Yeah, let's do it.
The emotional toolbox, which I have utilized as my version of nonviolent communication tactics coming from Marshall Rosenberg, is very simple. It is understanding the observations, which is on the tangible side, including thoughts that you'd have that you could write down as tangible. And you could see that that is flowing through a filter of what you value and desire and physiologically need. That is a list on the needs inventory list. If you go to cnvc.org needs inventory, you'd find that list. This is similar to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, except for instead of being built like a pyramid, it's more like a spreadsheet. And at any given point, you have a bunch of those popping up as critical, and some of them popping up as kind of you want it right now, and some of them being in the background because you have enough of it.
Mm-hmm.
So those are aspects. Your observations and thoughts flow through that filter of what you value and desire and need, and that creates your emotions. So both the values and desires and needs and the emotions or feelings are abstract or intangible, but your observations, including what you could write down as your thoughts, are tangible. Now, I'm not saying thoughts can be recorded. I'm saying that if you can write it down, it's tangible. But if
sure.
you cannot measure it or write it down, it's abstract.
Yeah.
And that flows to the third, which is, of course, actions, strategies, and requests of yourself and others.
Okay.
It's tangible.
Sure. So let's go back to the beginning there and talk about observations. These create emotions, right? So is there a place, especially in this context today's discussion, for evaluation between the two, between observations and feelings, that evaluating the observation might allow us to better understand or manage or master the emotional follow-up to that?
There's a place in evaluation at all times.
Yeah.
And there's obviously chances to over-evaluate, to mm-hmm. give adjectives to yourself and your own choice of actions or inactions, and to other people's choice of actions and inactions. Objection, Your Honor. Witness was non-responsive. And I'm sure we all have people out there that we've sent messages to, text messages, emails, and they were not responsive so far. And
sure.
This is happening for everyone out there. I'm sure there's someone out there, they have not answered you, and you're waiting on an answer. And that is an obstacle. So you can give them a label. I like to make my labels as specific as possible. So I just say being unresponsive rather than saying being an asshole, mm-hmm. which has absolutely no redeeming possibility for making a treatment plan. Unresponsive has a treatment plan. They could just respond, you know, but they have probably a reason for their choice of action. That's cause and effect. So there are things going on like that. You're just keeping in mind your how much evaluations are going on. Some people call that judgment. And I differ from many nonviolent communication practitioners in that I say, don't suppress judgments and evaluations. Just let them come. I'm just saying maybe don't hold on to them so much because there's so much more going on than just that. Take note of them. Write them down is helpful often. But notice, is it useful? Can you make a treatment plan around it, essentially? Or is it less productive? Is it simply an ad hominem, i.e. giving them a label or adjective?
Mm-hmm. But even within your own thinking, there's really evaluation is open throughout all four of these, throughout observation, throughout feelings, throughout needs or motivating factors, and throughout requests, right?
Right.
We're always evaluating.
Yeah. And to be clear, requests are strategies or plans of action and actual tangible action. And that requests is a quicker way of making it explicit that you're making a request of yourself, meaning you're making a plan of action, which is what I genuinely would emphasize and advise people to do, to not base it on someone else's choice of action, or occasionally that you're making a request of another person, like, Brett, will you have this podcast with me? Mm-hmm. And as I made a request, no, in this case, you made this request. you instigated this one. But in the past, I've made requests to people, and that's an example of it. I really like strategies and action, personally speaking, to describe them. And so now I wanted to say this. Observations, feelings, the values, desires, and needs, the requests or strategies and actions, I do an analysis of myself and the other person in real time as many times as I can. I do to see what am I thinking and observing, all my five senses, etc. What am I emotionally feeling, which lets me know what values and desires or needs am I after. And then I could make a request of myself, take a strategy, make an action even. And I do all that as many times as I can. And then I see the other person. How can they be seeing the situation with, say, suddenly finding out that the Skype recorder failed? And what could they be suddenly feeling, emotionally speaking, after that happened? And like I can imagine what their value and desire for in making an awesome production. Mm-hmm. I can perceive some of these things in my mind. So then, you know, I can find out, you know, I can evaluate what their strategies are and why they would be taking particular strategies. So I do a real-time analysis just to get a very simple idea of me and them. I have a split here in a little picture I drew for myself. And one side, I could say me, and it says, you know, it's split on two sides. Is it solid and balanced or is it unbalanced? And I'm speaking emotionally now. And then I see them. Are they solid and balanced or are they unbalanced? Now, people give away their emotions based upon their word usage, and if you are in face-to-face vision of them, their body language and mannerisms and behavior. It gives away how solid they are. So when the person brought up Jenny McCarthy in that whatever the topic was, because I'm gathering that you didn't start speaking of vaccination. I'm gathering you started off on a different topic.
Yep. This was my next question, by the way. So yes, please proceed.
Yeah, you see what I'm getting at is that I'm trying to create tact or empathy, and I define empathy as the knowledge of the OFNR, the observations, feelings, needs, values, and desires, and requests, strategies, and actions of myself and the other person. But that's just half of your traditional NVC. The other half is an explicit knowledge of the four Ds of disconnected communication.
So this first part is conversing consciously, we could call it.
Right. I'm trying to have voluntary communication. I'm trying to have everything explicit on the purposes and the utility being spelled out, and I'm trying to make some version of a tangible bridge of empathy. In some cases, I might find utility in knowing the other person's mental and emotional splinters, meaning cognitive dissonance, confirmation bias that they would have, their dependence or consistent use of logical fallacies. And when they would pop up on certain topics, I could flag certain topics and say, that's really emotional for them. And I flag that as a splinter, that there's something around there, something, a new term I found recently called conditioned aversion, where a topic pops up, and because of the story a person tells themselves, they have emotions pop up, and they have a conclusion which they're fixed on. They're not like the child and flexible and able to move. Instead, they're the old grumpy man or woman who thinks that they know it, and therefore it must be true. And there is no amount of evidence that will ever change that, and there is no exploration that's invited.
Yeah, it's like pre-censorship of the other person in the discussion.
Right. Right. Now, when I mentioned the 4Ds of disconnected communication, and I make a translation matrix for them, I use just basically the OFNR, the observations, feelings, needs, requests, plus 4Ds. That's your traditional NVC model. The 4Ds are making of demands, which I translate as a clumsy or semi-tragic way of making a request.
Mm-hmm.
They are the delivering of an unrequested diagnosis, something that I know as being in the medical field is completely inappropriate to deliver a diagnosis to someone who didn't ask for it or pay for it, especially when there's no tangible treatment plan, such as treatment for asshole. There's no treatment for at. So that's an unrequested diagnosis of any kind of, you know, coming at us or going out to another person. I translate that as a desire or value for understanding and clarity. People have a habit of putting other people and themselves in boxes, in little containers, like when you mentioned that in the debate contract of don't put someone in a box, including yourself.
Right.
But that's a habit for people because that's how they were attempting clarity and understanding. So I translate that as likely there is a value, and this was a tragic methodology. It's often tragic or often not designed to give you predictable and desirable results all the time, a way of trying to get for clarity or understanding. And that's the second D, is unrequested diagnosis. The third D is deserve-oriented language. This is entitlement speak. This is an adherence to punishments and rewards, or the idea that punishments and rewards has a grand and beautiful utility. And of course, this is a tragic way of having ease and efficiency or some sense of justice and equality. Sour grapes is what I call it, where because you had to go through it, now they do also. So you're dishing out what you were received previously. And that, of course, you know, fits the punishment reward model perfectly. It is, it's just another way that is likely to not lead to a harmonious internal and interpersonal situation, of having ease and efficiency because you've habitually done it, of having a type of sense of justice or a sense of equality. And the final D is denial of responsibility, the aspect of denying any cause and effect. It's denying one of the seven hermetic principles that there's no need for seeing cause and effect for the choice of action or inaction. And this may be a tragic or less than useful way of attaining ease and efficiency. Orders are orders, as Bill Buford said. Didn't work at Nuremberg, and it's likely not to add value to your life either if you take some time to analyze it. So right. I'm using these tools all the time in real time. I'm aiming for harmony internally to see how am I feeling solid? If I have the slightest bit of imbalance, I'm looking at internally in my chart of the needs inventory list of what things that I value and desire and need are subpar in how I'm acquiring it. If I'm having something where I'm feeling emotions that are popping up that make focus intellectually or emotionally challenging, I realize that something in there is not being tended to. And then after I get solid quickly, I try to make a little request of myself or a strategy saying, here's how I'm going to take care of myself either after the discussion or during, and do it all on my own without making any verbal requests of them. Then I'm going to see how are they doing? How balanced are they? And as soon as they brought up Jenny McCarthy, I can see that their potentially was some problem where questions of the scientific majority, which they might have referred to as the scientific consensus, were raised. And if you question that, well, then my God, you'd have to question all these pills that this person is taking or is giving to their children or their pets or anyone that they love, for example. And to raise those questions is unbalancing if you've never raised them before, if you don't feel safe in raising them. So the first thing I'm looking for is to see, are they solid or are they unbalanced? And the second thing is I'm going to see, what is the OFNR of them? What is an aspect of the 4Ds that are coming out of them, and how can I translate that?
Sure. And all of that being said, with respect to forming a connection during one of these potentially hostile discussions, can we talk about some strategies? And for many people, the people who've heard our series before, obviously some of this is review, but some strategies for better, more connected communication?
Yes. I like to go to the abstract side for many people, and I mean the values and desires and physiological needs, and speak directly maybe as a way of making a bridge to the person to say, for example, I heard you bring up Jenny McCarthy. That's an observation. You're speaking, you know, like you're attentive to them. And I'm not fully clear on why you brought that up, but I could possibly imagine, was it due to a desire for having, I would say, like valid information being raised when a discussion is happening rather than, information that's coming from very dubious sources or people who do not have the actual intellectual and the scientific chops to bring up information in the first place, such as Jenny McCarthy, for example. And I could bring that up as a question. I'm saying, is it because you want a sense of clarity and understanding, you know, and these are values and desires that are on the list. If I bring that up, I'm demonstrating that I'm paying attention. I'm demonstrating that I'm trying to demonstrate that I care about where they are emotionally. They might not equate that as emotional, and that's a good thing. I can be very clear, you know, I'm someone who uses these tactics in communication for the purpose of harmony. I don't try to hide that. I'm not trying to manipulate specifically other than to engineer harmony in a discussion. Mm-hmm. I could also refer to their observations, like I said, like I heard what you just said, and I think I can imagine significance of Jenny McCarthy in this discussion and why you brought that up. And that's essentially referring to an observation of them. And it's also referring to an observation of their tactics of action and strategy, which is in a way them making a request of me to pay attention to this little piece of information. And I speak to these three aspects, the observations and their values and desires and potentially possibly their needs for safety and security. Safety and security in the medical field is very critical for some people. And they might not differentiate it being that this is an academic discussion and not something that we're about to make a life-altering action choice with. Mm-hmm. So I try to understand where they're coming from. And also their strategies. I try to pay attention to that aspect as well. I try not to bring up their feelings unless there's someone who has an affinity to having their feelings being pointed out. Some people do. I like it when certain people that I really care about pay attention to what I'm feeling and they mention that. But I'm really cautious about that. I use that as maybe a lesser choice. I could also bring up my own observations, like what I was speaking of. I can reiterate, you know, just what I was observing. And I mean, not about them, but about our discussion and the purposes of, you know, why it's happening in the first place or how it's having a utility in our lives. I could mention my own values and desires and things that I need out of this whole situation.
Yeah.
And that's a way of bringing clarity. The other person can see that they share the same values and desires.
Yeah.
Because we all do, basically. We all have that list. And I could bring up my own choice of strategies and actions, my requests that I make of myself. I could make it explicit. I could say, while you were talking, I was noticing things in myself, and I was realizing I need more stability emotionally, so I'm taking care of that. I need more stability intellectually, so I'm writing down things to look up later on. And that's something I would do. And I might bring up my feelings if I think that they care about that.
I was going to ask when you were talking about, well, I might need more of this or I might need more of that, because it's very vulnerable. You know, now I certainly understand what you're saying about not bringing up the other person's feelings or being very cautious and really, you know, evaluating your relationship with whoever this person is before you do that, because obviously it could be seen by them, especially in a fairly hostile context, as a kind of diagnosis, right?
Right. And that's the thing where you're doing a diagnostic of the 4Ds also. You're always understanding that if the person interprets your words as being a diagnosis of them, like, you should be using this method to communicate. You should be using, you know, the OFNR plus the 4Ds to communicate, to keep emotional equilibrium. You should be using the Our Discussion flowchart, and you should have an explicit knowledge of all the informal logical fallacies in order to discuss with me. Otherwise, you are a subpar human. They could interpret that, you know, and I try to make it very clear. I could reiterate or say again, I'm not giving an evaluation or judgment to you. I'm not doing that. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to have a harmonious discussion for these purposes. And I see a utility in these ways. Here are the ways that I see this could be useful for our lives.
Right. You don't throw the political debate contract at them and say, here, this is so you can't get away with any of your crap.
No, I would be aiming for harmony first. And if I have that harmony,
right,
then I could show them the contract. The contract is going to be confusing to anyone who has not clicked on the links of the fallacies that are highlighted there.
Sure.
If you've never, ever heard of the straw man argument, if you've never heard of an ad hominem, if you think that those are methodologies of supportive evidence, that's going to be a revelation for you. If you think that you can make a claim and not have anything to support it, because it's something that you would call an axiom, such as God exists, I just know it, and I don't need any evidence for it, for example. I don't even need to define what I'm speaking about. You know, you're finding out that, you know, that this is an aspect of the person's terrain, both intellectually and emotionally.
Right.
And that's giving you splinter possibilities, meaning these are disharmonious areas. If you touch upon those areas, you could be finding ways of, you know, adding to the person's already disharmonious situation, emotionally speaking.
Absolutely.
So we've looked at now ways of talking. You can use the trivium. You can go through first who, what, where, and when, grammar, knowledge, your computer input. You can go through that. You go through next with your logic or answering why, removing contradictions. That includes the logical fallacy lists. And then you try to find the practical applications of your grammar and logic, your answering of how, your demonstration. And these are the words that you use, your rhetorical triangle analysis. That's the art of rhetoric, where right now I'm the author. These words I'm saying are my message. Brett and the School Sucks podcast audience are my audience. And I'm keeping this in mind, as I know Brett, you know, to some degree, but I know some of the audience too. And this analysis, with the context of how this conversation is flowing, it's flowing here, January 2015, we're in the future. And, you know, we're keeping all this, these things in mind. We have potential now. We've spread out all the tools. All we need to do is put it into a practical application. And that will show the full demonstration in the next show.
Absolutely. You know, just to jump back a little bit before we wrap up today, I think that one of the things that can help with productivity in these discussions is attention to pace. There often seems to be a super rush, right? And it's because both people want to talk. And maybe it's not a discussion. Maybe it's two people trying to give sermons and they've each mistaken it for a discussion. But good candidates for these kinds of productive discussions, or trying to find good candidates, a question that might be worth raising at the beginning is, can we really pace ourselves here? Can we really be deliberate through the grammar part of this discussion? Because I've heard, you know, so many discussions that are completely off the rails but continue to go on at full speed, and the two parties, and maybe I've been one of those parties at some points in the past, but the two parties don't even know what the other is talking about. So if somebody is determined to have a conversation for the purpose of connection, exploration, understanding, any productive label that you want to put to it, I would really encourage people to ask for time in the beginning to be thorough with grammar. I think that is super, super important, and I think it is one of the biggest mistakes that people make in these kinds of discussions, whether they're happening online or in person. There's this franticness of rushing that's so common, and I think if that's something that can be addressed, acknowledged and addressed, discussions that take their time with grammar could lead to far more productive outcomes.
Exactly. And the GTD method from David Allen has three brilliant tenets that I always mention and isolate in many of my discussions with people like you, Brett. I mention the objectives, which I named as purposes. So when you know your objectives, you can be clear on number two, what actions will get me to my objective? So the methodology we've been outlining throughout this whole show today, we're describing specific types of actions that could lead to our objectives. And finally, number three, the resources that you need to take those actions to get to your objectives. So the resources that you just mentioned right there were time, taking slow pace or a deliberate pace at least, so that you can get there. Kind of like if I was to run to one of the local beaches, that would actually take, at this point, you know, like from starting parking to get to the beach, if you were running full tilt, it would probably take 50 minutes. And I think you'd be pretty worn out. You know, it could take longer even because you're running on the cliffs of rock. So that's tough.
Yes.
If you were taking your slow pace time of it, you could be stopping, taking pictures of the beauty around you, taking in the thing. And if you're going with a friend, you can actually have a pleasant conversation. Whereas if you're in a race, you know, to see who wins the beach first, you know, then it's a whole different type of thing.
Yeah, a lot of the appreciation for life is lost through rushing. The same is true in these interactions. You might not get the exact outcome that you want. You might not convince or persuade the other person, but it doesn't mean that it can't be a valuable and enriching experience.
Precisely.
I think we got it.
We did it!
Try to see it my way. Do I have to go on talking till I can't go on? Why we see it your way? Run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We got what we got. We got what we got. Think of what you're saying. You can get it wrong, but still you think that it's alright. Think of what I'm saying. We can work it out, get it straight, or say goodnight. We can work it out. We can work it out. Life is very short, and there's no time for fussing and fighting, my friend. I have always thought that it's a tell if I'm right or I'm wrong. Why we see it your way? There's a chance that we may fall apart before too long. We can work it out. We can work it out.
We can